This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and events continue to unfold at the Occupy Wall Street site, as well as now in dozens of other venues across the country. Over the weekend, there were nearly 1,000 arrests as marchers sought economic and social justice during a march across the Brooklyn Bridge. We have a guest highly prepared to speak about that in the person of Margaret Ratner Kunstler, a dynamo from a dynasty of radical attorneys. She is the widow of William Moses Kunstler, the mother of Sarah Kunstler, who prevailed in recent litigation over the 2004 mass arrests here in New York City. And part of a long chain of litigation on behalf of civil liberties, civil rights, and human rights. Most recently, Margaret Ratner Kunstler is the co-author of the new book, Hell No, Your Right to Dissent in 21st Century America. Margaret Ratner Kunstler now joins us live. Welcome, Margie.
Thank you. That was quite an introduction.
Well, it's quite a life. We have... are aware that you have been on high state of alarm over what happened with the demonstrators this weekend in a march across the Brooklyn Bridge. What is your objection to what happened to those protesters and the police procedures?
Well, it's in my opinion they were arrested illegally. You can't arrest someone unless they know that they're violating the law. An unintentional violation in this kind of situation just doesn't hold water. And many of the protesters that I spoke to said that they didn't know what they were doing was illegal. So they didn't hear any announcement that said, disperse, what you're doing is illegal or we'll arrest you. The police just decided to arrest them. And I have a theory about that arrest.
Pray tell.
Well, given the fact that there was no pre-preparation of a place to put people, during the RNC, they had the pier in New York City where they locked up hundreds and hundreds of demonstrators. But there was no place to put the 800 people. So they had determined that they were going to arrest them and release them. Why do that? Do that because you want to gain their names. You want their pedigree information. You want to gain intelligence.
Margie, one of the things that has been taken up by the opponents of the Occupy Wall Street movement is a police-produced video in which Fox and Post and other people are claiming that the police did the right thing. They gave proper notification, and here's the proof of it. Here's the video. Here's 35 seconds of that sound. I'd like to ask you about that.
Ladies and gentlemen, since you have refused to leave this roadway, I am ordering your arrest of disorderly conduct. If you do not accompany the arrest officer voluntarily to the prison transport vehicle, you must be carried. You'll be charged with the initial court of obstructing government administration.
A moment from the Brooklyn Bridge crossing this past weekend here in New York City. And Margaret, there was a police white shirt with a megaphone that was very difficult for us to hear in the actuality, and certainly perhaps not so easy for the thousands and thousands and thousands of people who were allowed, permitted by the police to go into the walkway. With that countermanding assertion by the NYPD, did they, through these other circumstances, in fact, engage in entrapment?
Well, you know, you could argue that quite easily, and I think that I don't think we'd win on that. But you and I know that it was a form of entrapment, and you and I know that honestly, people did not hear that speech. You know, I mean, the white shirt with his megaphone, you know, was at one side. There were thousands of people chanting. And there was no way that I don't doubt that some people heard it. But let's go to trial and determine who violated the law there. You have to have some kind of notice And if someone doesn't know that it's illegal to do that and has not been told, then they're innocent.
You raised a disturbing point a moment ago when you said that the purpose of these arrests might well have been data mining, data phishing, to set up an enemies list or a possible future prosecution list by getting the identities of people who are there on what may seem a small charge of an arrest, but building a big dossier. Can you talk more about how that process is underway in today's policing in America?
Okay. You know, it's the beginning of a dossier. I mean, if you were arrested and they have your name, it's not a no-fly list yet. You know, they have these computer centers all across this country that are federal and state joined groups that mine information. And they mine who goes to demonstrations. They have, anybody who saw the 60 Minutes on New York City anti-terrorism work understands that the New York City police have photographs of people who go to demonstration, and they can figure out by facial whether you were at this demonstration or the next one. This is all data that they're collecting. It doesn't mean you're on a no-fly list or whatever, but should they want to get you, you know, should you come up too many times, should they notice you're speaking someplace, should they notice you're being too effective, they can gather all of this information and they can see where you were, who you were with, and what you were doing.
There was recently created in mid-August in the New York City Police Department a so-called social media networking task force, whose operations presumably are to do data mining on such vulnerabilities as Facebook, Twitter, records of internet operations of an individual. And do you see that new cybernetic form of investigation as being part of a chill to the freedom of expression?
Oh, absolutely. How could it not be? You know, I mean, this is a form of communication. Communications should be private. There's no reason to have government surveillance of these things unless, you know, it's a state protecting its power. You know, it's one of the worst things a state can do.
Can you, as a constitutional scholar, explain to us what reasonable expectation of privacy is?
Well, that has changed. Reasonable expectation of privacy used to be a wonderful thing. That, if, for example, if you went into a phone booth, for example, and it wasn't your own private phone, the law said that you had, even though it wasn't your phone and you didn't pay the bills on it, that you made a telephone call from that phone booth, you had a reasonable expectation of privacy. All of these things existed with your bank account, with your phone, with whatever forms, your letters. You had an expectation of privacy that was quite reasonable. Now, an expectation of privacy has really become unreasonable because under the Patriot Act, the surveillance of bank accounts, of international communications, even national communications under certain circumstances that are quite loose, you have very little expectation of privacy. It doesn't mean you don't have privacy rights. It's just that realistically, your expectations are incorrect.
Well, as a case in point, Facebook has become very popular. There are nearly a billion people involved in it. And yet, Facebook has turned into a hoarder of personal information that does not disappear when one deletes or removes oneself from their operation or membership. The accumulation of data by Facebook, the records of Twitter, and similar social communications media, thereby seems to me, Margie, to take surveillance or accumulation of data into private corporate hands that ultimately may be at jeopardy to seizure of those records by federal, local, and state authorities. Are you concerned about the interface between private hoarding of data and prosecutorial phishing expeditions?
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, that exists for your banking data under the Patriot Act. That not only can the federal government request information about your banking, but the bank is forbidden to tell you about it. So, I mean, as we progress into this information gathering state, it's very easy for another law to be passed under. Another segment to be passed under the Patriot Act, which also says yes, and we can request all of this information from Twitter, from Facebook, and the fact that this information exists makes it subject to seizure.
Let me add another factor here. There is a process people sometimes mistakenly call it GPS, Global Positioning Satellite Data, but the local cell phone repeater towers are used to triangulate very precise locations of cell phones that are always busy snitching back to the cell phone provider. And in conjunction with that, we here were alarmed by a recent vote of the House Judiciary Committee that advocated requiring internet service providers and telephone companies to maintain 2 years of browsing records and phone history. And is that not sort of like a lost leader into
Absolutely.
A surveillance state?
Absolutely. You know, I mean, then in any event, a subpoena is all that's required. And, you know, if there's any suspicion of any sort, but at least there would require a subpoena you'd have to go to a court. But, you know, I mean, I don't know what at least that's some form of protection. You can't answer it because the subpoena is either granted or not granted, and you have no role in it. You wouldn't even know about it. But it could, the Patriot Act could be expanded to take away the subpoena requirement.
I understand that the FBI officials there are already asserting their right to obtain private communications records without the order, without a court order or a subpoena, and even beyond the terms of the FISA.
That's true, and it's, you know, obviously it's very difficult to fight if you don't know about it. So it's a very difficult situation. I think that it.
Yeah. Go.
No, I think that there may be some sane heads that prevail here that don't quite go along with all of this.
Your new book is called Hell No, Your Right to Dissent in 21st Century America. Tell me about the book and how that addresses these issues.
Well, the book discusses the situation in the United States subsequent, really, to Seattle and 9/11. Seattle laid the groundwork, and 9/11 provided the funds for all of these state and federal police operations to gather intelligence, and not only to gather intelligence, but to actively interfere with organizing for demonstrations. And in the process of writing this book, you know, it was a really depressing experience because what we learned was, not only were the laws in place, but beyond the laws, all of the police forces across the country and the federal authorities, who directly participate in all of this anti-demonstration activity, were being effective in their actions. In other words, they were penning people. They were refusing permits. They were refusing people to march. They were using netting. They were dressing up as ninjas. They were putting tanks on the streets. They were frightening people, and people were not demonstrating. So the change here, I mean, this is a wonderful thing, this occupation movement that's happening, because it's a fight back against that. And here we are alive again, because the only way we're going to have changed in this country, or anywhere for that matter, is if people can be in the streets and make their voices known.
Who is the publisher, your co-authors? How can people find more about the book, Hell No, Your Right to Dissent in 21st Century America?
Michael Ratner is the co-author, and it's published by the New Press. And I'm sure it's available on the center line or from New Press.
Margaret, there was an expression during the days of the mass global struggle against apartheid. Alan Bosack once said, never has there been a moment like this. Can you put into context from your long and noble history of civil rights and human rights and civil liberties and so on, how strong this movement stands, how much it can proliferate, and what are the options of the state, and can the people prevail?
Well, you know, I've been following this movement, and I am tremendously excited by it. I'm excited by it on multiple levels. I've been following Anonymous for the last 6 months or so, and they were very instrumental in bringing attention to this movement. They were not the founders of it, but they were very, very effective. And so this has been a growing activity on the internet, and I've been watching it grow on the internet, and I'm saying to myself, if only we could just move into the streets, and it happened. So to me, it's the most exciting because it can't just be on the internet, because if change is going to occur, it happens because people put their bodies on the line and they say, here I am, count me, this is my position. And it's wonderful in other ways. I think the ways that they're making decisions and the ways that they're seeking consensus, you know, is something new, is something so much better than what we have done in the past. Maybe there won't be this self-defeating, self-destructive infighting if consensus can be a way of operating. It's very exciting on all levels, and it's happening, you know, it's being picked up across the country. So, you know, it's contagious, it's exciting, and people are engaged.
Margaret Ratner Kunstler, a radical attorney, and the co-author of the new book that should be a handbook for freedom for all of us. It's called Hell No, Your Right to Dissent in 21st Century America. Congratulations, Margie.
Thank you so much.
And thanks for an enlightening interview.
Thank you for having me.
This is 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. I'm Robert Knight in New York. And even as we speak, there is a scheduled, if not in real time, plan for a joint march or operation between the Occupy Wall Street movement and the International Teamsters Union. We'll keep you apprised of breaking developments as they may occur during the course of today's program. But also taking part today in the Wall Street occupation was the Peace Action Fund of New York State, and we are now joined live by the executive director of the fund, Alicia Godsberg. Alicia, welcome to the Shadow.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, what did you do today?
Well, today we met up with some of our other Peace Action New York State members from Staten Island, even from Binghamton came down. And we went down to the Occupy Wall Street people at around noon and talked to some people. We basically went as a peace movement to show solidarity with their message.
I don't know if Wall Street is the home of Mammon or Mecca for progressive politics in America and around the world today, but what was your impression upon your crossing that horizon?
Well, I think it was very interesting to see all the organization that was going on there. If you believe the local or even the national media, there's no message, there's no organization. But I didn't find that to be the case. There were media people, there was a kitchen, there were people taking volunteers, there were some people talking to the media as representatives of parts of the group and then leading a march at about noon. So I found it to be very interesting and also very cool to see people from all over the world there as well, taking video and talking with people. So it seems like the message is spreading.
One of the key elements here is for economic and social justice. And you of the Peace Action Fund of New York State are of a pacifist agenda, I would assume. And can you take a moment to tell us about the kind of work that you do?
Sure, I'd be happy to. Peace Action is the oldest and largest grassroots peace organization in the country. Got about 100,000 activists nationwide, and it started from the same nuclear freeze movement started in the 1950s. Now the agenda has broadened a little bit, and we work on anti-militarism and also anti-nuclear weapons work. One of the big things that we're doing now is working on this Move the Money campaign, and that's kind of why we went down to Wall Street. Peace Action New York State, we have 18 chapters throughout the state, and a lot of us went down there today to talk about the cost of war, especially the financial cost in this context, where we're almost 10 years into this war. On Thursday, Friday, we celebrate the anniversary, the 10-year anniversary of invading Afghanistan. It's costing American taxpayers $1 trillion. Meanwhile, the latest U.S. Census says that 1 in 5 Americans is living under the poverty line in this country. And we think this is a crisis of priorities, and that's what we wanted to go down and share.
You say move the money. There's certainly a lot of money being moved on Wall Street on behalf of munitions makers, of war privateers, and so on. Can you tell us a little bit more about the Move the Money campaign of Peace Action, as well as your impression regarding the presence or absence of calls for ending wars in the daily evolving agenda of the Wall Street occupation?
Yes, I thought that was interesting, too. I did see some that some Marines were going down there in uniform to support the people on Wall Street. But they're not really talking much about an anti-war agenda right now, although they are taking information and having general assemblies to discuss which other actions they're going to support. And that's kind of what the Cost of War Awareness Project is trying to evolve into, kind of coalition building through the New Priorities Network, which is something that is about a year old, with not only peace groups but labor groups, other economic and social justice groups, where we're talking to people basically across the board who are affected by budget cuts locally. And these budget cuts are basically due to the wrong priorities of our federal government, not funding states, not funding social services, and funding the war. And you're quite right. Billions of dollars are traded on Wall Street for the military-industrial complex. And one of the big reasons we went down there today was to talk with people about this connection. And we're going to keep going down there, and we're going to keep trying to bring this to their attention.
Alicia, how does Wall Street launder war money?
Well, that's a good question. I don't know that they launder war money. I mean, these are our government's policies. You know, Congress creates my employee is leaving. Congress takes money from the military contractors. They want to keep jobs in their district, so they say this is necessary to keep this type of production going. They fight for programs like the second jet engine for the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter that even the Pentagon said it didn't want, only because they want to keep money flowing into the districts in a very short-sighted way, whereas military spending, if you break it down, actually does not create as much jobs as civilian spending. So it's just wrong-guided, short-sighted policies of Congress. And with all the momentum going on across the country, starting here in Wall Street, we're hoping that that message gets out there.
Well, thank you for your insight. And tell people how they might follow or be involved in the work of the Peace Action Fund of New York State.
Thank you very much. Yes. You can see us on the web. Our web address is www.panys.org. That's for Peace Action New York State. Our national organization is peace-action.org. That's the D.C. national office. And you can also look at the newpriorietiesnetwork.org, and that will tell you a little bit more about the larger cost of war campaign.
Well, thank you so much. Alicia Godsberg is the executive director of the Peace Action Fund of New York State. This is 5 o'clock Shadow, and there is a new document coming out of the Wall Street occupation that seeks to address some specificities that are emerging from the global consensus, not only on Wall Street, but all across the country in dozens and scores of cities now. And here are some of the specificities that have emerged from Liberty Square thus far. The organizers say that this is a work in progress, but for the record, I thought it might be good to hear the particular items that have thus far been brought up, discussed, and approved by the human loudspeaker, the human microphone, General Assemblies here in New York City at Wall Street. The document is titled Declaration of the Occupation of New York City, accepted by the NYC General Assembly on the 29th of September, revised on October 1st. And following a preamble, it says that they let these facts be known. And here now the points of specificity that have evolved so far. Quoting, "They have taken our houses through an illegal foreclosure process despite not having the original mortgage. They have taken bailouts from taxpayers with impunity and continue to give executives exorbitant bonuses. They have perpetuated inequality and discrimination in the workplace based on age, the color of one's skin, sex, gender identity, and sexual orientation. They have poisoned the food supply through negligence and undermined the farming system through monopolization. They have profited off the torture, confinement, and cruel treatment of countless animals and actively hide these practices. They have continuously sought to strip employees of the right to negotiate for better pay and safer working conditions. They have held students hostage with tens of thousands of dollars of debt on education, which itself is a human right. They have consistently outsourced labor and used that outsourcing as leverage to cut workers' health care and pay. They have influenced the courts to achieve the same rights as people, the corporations have, with none of the responsibility. They have spent millions of dollars on legal teams that look for ways to get them out of contracts in regards to health insurance. They have sold our privacy as a commodity. They have used the military and police force to prevent freedom of the press. They have deliberately declined to recall faulty products, endangering lives in pursuit of profit. They determine economic policy despite the catastrophic failures their policies have produced and continue to produce. They have donated large sums of money to politicians who are responsible for regulating them. They continue to block alternate forms of energy to keep us dependent on oil. They continue to block generic forms of medicine that could save people's lives or provide relief in order to protect investments that have already turned a substantial profit. They have purposely covered up oil spills, accidents, faulty bookkeeping, and inactive ingredients in pursuit of profit. They purposefully keep people misinformed and fearful through their control of the media. They have accepted private contracts to murder prisoners, even when presented with serious doubts about their guilt. They have perpetuated colonialism at home and abroad. They have participated in the torture and murder of innocent civilians overseas. They continue to create weapons of mass destruction in order to receive government contracts. To the people of the world, we, the New York City General Assembly occupying Wall Street and Liberty Square, urge you to assert your power. Exercise your right to peaceably assemble, occupy public space, create a process to address the problems we face, and generate solutions accessible to everyone. To all communities that take action and form groups in the spirit of direct democracy, we offer support, documentation, and all of the resources at our disposal. Join us and make your voices heard. The New York City General Assembly Declaration of the Occupation of New York City at the intersection of Broadway and Liberty on this 17th day that shook the Wall Street area. This is 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. I'm Robert Knight in New York.